Okay, welcome everyone. We're going to go ahead and start the program. So my name is Kate Stedman. I am a committee chair for the Society of Health Policy Young Professionals, which is sponsoring this event. And I also work here at Kaiser. So they graciously let us use their facilities. And we're also webcasting the event. It will be available on kaisernetwork.org tomorrow by 5 p.m. So if you want to like send it around to your friends or anything like that, that would be great. So we have a few other upcoming events I'm just going to mention briefly before we go ahead to the program. The first is there's a discussion with Alice Rivlin, and it's on poverty, economy, and health. That is on December 2nd, and the location is still TBD. So you can always check our website, which is dchealthpolicy.org. for more information, and we also encourage you to sign up for our listserv and get our emails if you haven't, and you can also do that at our website. So the next event after that is a skills building event. At the Society, we try and provide a variety of events, so some are more roundtable events like this one. We have happy hours, and then we also try and do professional development, and we've also recently started some community service events. So there's all of these on our list right now. The skills building event is an interviewing and resume writing skills event. And that is on Wednesday, December 10th. It's at GW in Ross Hall, room 115. There's our December happy hour and food drive, which is on Friday, December 12th. And that is at the front page in DuPont. And then our community service event is Saturday, December 13th, from 9 to noon. We'll be working with Food for All, and you will meet at the Universalist National Memorial Church on 16th Street. And again, information about all of these things is available on our website. So, to tonight's event, we obviously had a very exciting election recently. Health reform definitely played a part, particularly in the primaries. And tonight we have convened two panelists who have been around for a while with all the variations of, you know, health policy on the left and the right. And so we've asked them to kind of come here tonight, talk to us, give us an idea of what they think new trends are, what did the election mean, you know, what are we expecting with the new administration? So first we have Henry Aaron, who is a senior fellow of economic studies at the Brookings Institution. And then we have Stuart Butler, who is vice president of domestic and economic policy at the Heritage Foundation. And both will be providing different perspectives on health policy, our favorite issue. And then Dave is going to be moderating tonight for us. And let's get started.
Great.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you, Kate. Thank you, everyone. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming out here tonight on a cold evening. As Kate mentioned, this month in November has been sort of a capping off of what is probably one of the most politically charged seasons in perhaps decades. Certainly here in D.C., we feel it quite well. Healthcare, as she mentioned, was obviously very much prominent in the election. I think for many of us who are in health policy or healthcare, probably wanted to see it actually elevated even further. But we know that there were national issues both with the war and with the economy that perhaps might have overshadowed it a bit. But I think part of what we're going to discuss today is, in fact, the role of healthcare in the new agenda that's going to be debated by both the Congress and coming from the White House, and perhaps what all of our roles are in making healthcare a top domestic priority, regardless of what other priorities are, in fact, being addressed by the policymakers. It's very fitting that we're here tonight to talk about it because of the times and because of what lies ahead. And I think there perhaps is no need, though, to speak in this room about why healthcare should be a priority. And we won't be talking about why healthcare is a priority. There's no need, in part because of the folks who are here tonight. We're here with the Society for Young Health Policy Professionals, and by definition, we are folks who are very interested in this topic. And many of you work in the field or are active or are learning in the field. But this room in particular, the Barbara Jordan Conference Center here at Kaiser, is absolutely fitting and one that represents a lot of the most advanced scholarly pursuit in both research and in policymaking for healthcare. So this isn't a place we need to convince anyone of why healthcare is important. What we do need to do is figure out what is that the magic, that key that's going to help solve this crisis once and for all. And I'm sure if any of us, including our panelists, had that key, they'd probably be accepting some nomination any day now. And what we're hoping for is to help us all to get there. The event tonight is called Across the Spectrum, Perspectives on Health Reform from the Political Left and Right. And I think regardless of the outcome of the election, which looked to be what people consider sort of a victory for those on the progressive side of the Democrats, I think all acknowledge, including those in healthcare, that it will absolutely take a very wide range of effort, a true partnership at the table, across party lines, across the aisle, and a bipartisan effort to put in what is one of the largest and certainly a very costly impacting issue, which is healthcare. And so bringing together two of our esteemed colleagues to come and talk about this is very reflective of what's going to be happening not only at every single think tank and policy wonk shop here in the District of Columbia, but what's going to be happening on the Hill pretty much every day is these kind of discussions and these kind of coalition building that's going to have to happen. So again, we have both Henry Aaron from the Brookings Institution and Stuart Butler from the Heritage Foundation, who have very long and storied careers working on health policy. And in fact, while they may have espoused very interesting views that may not have always been convergent over the years, I think they have represented some partnerships that have developed over the past couple of years. And it talks a lot about and perhaps is a template for how we can move forward and sort of get past some of the partisan bickering that's been happening on the Hill. And that's why we're very happy and thankful to have them here tonight. So we're going to jump right in, and we're going to talk about some nitty-gritty. I'm going to ask a few questions of the panelists and have them respond with their thoughts and their feedback, and then we're going to open it up. We're going to spend a good portion of this evening sort of town hall style, and so we encourage you to begin thinking right now of your questions. We'll have two folks with mics that will come around, and we'll be taking your questions, and we'll do that for a while before we close. So we're going to go ahead and get started. I think we all talk about every aspiring health policy wonk understands sort of the three-legged stool in healthcare, and that would be cost, access, and quality. And you hear about it in any lessons you talk about, in any writings you talk about. So we know that any one of them can absolutely be maximized if you disregard the other two. And we know that we could probably even get two out of the three very well if, in fact, we neglect the third. But everyone is looking for how to find that magic bullet to solve all three. And so my question to the panelists is, what is the magic bullet? How do you solve quality, access, and cost in our healthcare system? And we can, Stuart, if you want to go first.
Oh, I got to go first on that. Well, I think just to first of all, to comment on the question itself, and let me just say, if Henry and I had the answer, the exact answer to that, we would never let anybody know, because we would then be able to monopolize all the opportunities in healthcare. But I think that the question underscores not just a technical challenge in terms of how do you deal with each of these elements, but a political challenge in the sense that I think when you look at how Americans look at health care, they would look at something like that and tend to say, well, of course you can do all those things. You can bring costs down, you can improve quality, you can give access, you get rid of waste, and you make a few changes, and surely it will happen. And I think it underscores the disconnect, maybe disconnect is too strong a word, but certainly the difference in how analysts and professionals look at the challenge and how ordinary Americans look at it. And that's why I think when you say, how do you solve this, I think it requires a solution that both is digestible and understandable and agreeable to the average American, but also works technically. And that's very difficult to do. For example, I think it does mean that when you start measuring quality and measuring outcomes, value for the dollar, and so on, you would have to do things differently. You'd have to bring about a situation where certain kinds of services are not provided to people, or not provided in the way that people think they ought to get them, or their doctor tells them they ought to get them, and so on. And that is very much at odds with I think, how a lot of Americans look at this. So the short answer, then, is really there isn't a simple magic bullet, because the magic bullet would have to work both in the political context and in the technical context. It's easier in the technical context to do it, but the way you would do it there raises all kinds of political problems in terms of how you would get the Congress and the American people to go along with that. Bill Clinton had learned that. I think President-elect Obama is going to learn this. It's going to be very, very difficult. So for those of you in the audience, there's going to be good, steady work for years to come in this area, because this is not something where there is going to be a magic bullet and we're going to solve this problem.
Henry?
I think it was useful to start off by emphasizing that although Stuart and I come from different points on the political spectrum, we have managed to find common ground and work together and co-author pieces on what we think would be a constructive approach to dealing with health care reform. And I think that reflects the fact that there are analytical questions that transcend what may be political or ideological differences, and it's important to take advantage of those when they occur. The phrasing of the question suggests that there is a necessarily a trade-off. You get more of one of those three objectives, you get less of the other two. To some significant degree, that is certainly the case. But in one key respect, I think there is a complementarity that is important to recognize. As Stuart said, in the long run, well, let's back up a bit. With respect to cost, there are a great many inefficiencies in the current system. Each of you could enumerate them. I'm sure you've read many articles documenting them, as have we. Those are things that need to be done in order to achieve relatively straightforward economies and improvements in efficiency. The driving force for cost over the long haul and the source of increases in healthcare spending that pose really very serious threats to public budgets and private budgets are not those inefficiencies. It's not the fact that we have an administratively kludgy system. It's not that we do too many MRIs. It's that there's a steady flow of new technologies coming on stream all the time, some substantial part of which provide benefits that we would all like to have, but that are used in a large number of cases as well, where the benefits are relatively small or even non-existent, as in the case of MRIs. And Stuart was emphasizing that in the long haul, in order to significantly bend the curve, as a report on the from the Commonwealth Foundation put it, bend the curve of rising healthcare spending, some people are not going to receive services that provide benefits that just aren't worth the cost. Now, suppose you try to do that within an environment where some people are insured and some people aren't. Providers are squeezed in some fashion. Their budgets are limited. Their resources are constrained. Whom do they take care of? They take care of the strong payers. So in that situation, I believe efforts to achieve cost control would give a whole new and terrifying meaning to what it would mean not to be insured. So much so that consequences of serious efforts to control spending would result in inequities that would discredit the entire effort to control spending. For that reason, I believe that a necessary precondition for successful long-run cost control is to provide coverage in some form, leaves open up how generous, what the terms are, but it is necessary to provide coverage in some form for everyone. This is counterintuitive. People commonly say that achieving greater efficiency in the healthcare system, controlling healthcare spending, is necessary to cover the added costs of covering the uninsured. I am suggesting that while that has some element of truth to it, there's a deeper truth on the other side. If we are to be able to institute and sustain long-term cost control, we have to cover everyone.
Well, thank you, Henry. Before moving on, I think what may help us, as this question often is one of the most commonly asked and worked on, the issue of the three-legged stool, if we could talk about maybe why don't you define, if you could, three or four core principles that you think are critical or necessary in reforming the healthcare system or in building a functioning healthcare system. And obviously, for our purposes, we would welcome you to look at it from the viewpoint of the right or the left, knowing that you can't speak for the entire movement, but whether it's both your personal philosophy or where you feel like the movements are at, What are the underlying values? Because that obviously colors how then the strategies get built.
Let me respond first then. I would say, let me pull out three which I think characterize not only people on the center-right, but certainly I think characterize them. The first is, and I just wanted to start really where Henry ended, that the principle and the value of having a society in which everybody in this country has access to affordable, adequate levels of health care is a basic value that is not left or right. It's a shared value. There will be argument, and there is argument, about what the word adequate means, affordable, and so on. But the basic value of a society that has that one at its core is I think, shared. And I think that needs to be said, because I think sometimes people don't understand that.
Sure. You don't sound too defensive there. Sure.
No, I'm not trying to be defensive. But sometimes arguments over the practical ways of getting things get in the way that we actually still want to get to the same result. I'd say a second very core principle that certainly applies to people specifically on the center-right is the idea that ultimately the control, that the people who should be most empowered to make decisions about health care are American families, not corporations, not the government. Again, that pans out in all kinds of ways and there's debates and so on, but I think that's an important value. That does lead, of course, to specific kind of areas like choice, like benefits packages and this sort of thing. Who determines those? That idea of who should be ultimately in control is central. And I'd say the third part of it is the notion of a limited, important but limited role of government. I think conservatives in general, like everybody, does not want to have unlimited government. But the idea of thinking very carefully about the limits and the proper role of government is a very important value and a very important piece of the architecture. It's an area actually where, of course, Henry and I have worked together on in terms of looking at even within the government sector, the role of the national government, the state government, how you get the political process to function and where the authority should be within that. I think that's a very, very important piece of it too. And I mention each of those because I think that when you start looking at debate over very specific issues, then it's both a technical debate, of course, but it's also a debate that's shaped by those underlying values. That's why I'm very askance and very skeptical of things like a national plan devised in Washington. It's why I'm very nervous about the idea of some kind of centralized or standardized benefits package, that if I personally don't want to have those benefits and so on, you know, why should they be imposed on me? That's how it comes out. And there's lots of technical questions, I understand that, in terms of how this all works out. But I think those are basic values that you'll hear a lot from people who are committed to the goal, but are nervous or skeptical or argue about some of the means of getting there.
I'd like to start by emphasizing the importance of what Stuart said about the value of access to affordable health care for all. I think it's fair to say that across the political spectrum, that is not a universally held view. And the fact that Stuart, as a conservative, embraces that principle is genuinely important and is maybe a key reason why we get along reasonably well together.
Makes it a bit easier.
I think it does. I'd like to, you know, you say you can teach a parrot to say supply and demand and you've made an economist. Let me say supply and demand as two principles and talk a bit about each of them. From the standpoint of long-term control of the growth of healthcare spending, getting demand-side incentives better than they are today is an important, desirable, and constructive reform. And not all people on the left side of the political spectrum would say that, and this may be another reason why Stuart and I get along well together. However, I think that getting those incentives straight and involving consumers and households in decision-making wherever possible is highly desirable for a whole host of reasons, both analytic and political. My view is that over the long haul, the capacity of demand-side policies, cost-sharing, deductibles of various kinds, and so on, to slow the growth of healthcare spending is decidedly limited. In support of that, and I realize this is not conclusive evidence by any means, I believe it is the case that there is no other country in the world, developed country in the world, all of whom spend substantially less than we do. The next 10 richest countries in the world spend, on average, half of what the United States spends per capita on health care. None relies primarily on demand-side incentives for cost control. All, in one fashion or another, through a host of very diverse institutions, have evolved various limits on supply. It may be, in extreme cases, budgets operating on hospitals. In other cases, it's restrictions on the capacity to invest in costly new medical procedures or on which groups can provide those services. Currently in the United States, we have very few of those limits, and I believe that that is one of the reasons why most of the conversation about cost control in the United States today does not rise significantly above the level of cocktail party chit-chat. People talk with intense feeling at a high decibel level, just the way you do at a cocktail party, and the impact on policy or behavior of healthcare providers of these ideas is, so far at least, negligible. So my principles are work both sides of the street, try to get demand-side incentives straight because doing so will help in a variety of ways to improve efficiency and to help control spending, but that we will not significantly, to use the phrase again, bend the curve until as a nation we are prepared to a greater extent than is the case today to use supply-side constraints to limit the growth of healthcare spending.
Right. I want to follow up a little bit on the next question. Part of a lot of what you said, Stuart, is really defining the role of the different entities in the healthcare sector. And the question centers on financing. So what do you think the role of government is, federal and state, both, or even localities, employers, individuals, and other entities in healthcare in terms of paying for coverage? But maybe I'll add to that some other elements that you brought up, one of which is deciding what coverage should be, and then the last one might be healthcare decision-making. So
you don't want to add anything to that list at all.
I'm sticking to three,
to keep up
no more
than three.
So, yeah, so talk about the different roles of the different players, primarily in financing, but even some of these other.
Try to do that briefly.
Sure.
And let me just say at the outset, ultimately, people pay the tab. The idea that an employer is somehow like a Martian that's sort of separate from the real world, you know, when employers pay for health care, ultimately somebody, ordinary people, end up paying that either in the cost of goods or more typically in terms of their income, their wages. So I think, you know, to some extent, I'm answering your question, first of all, by saying, well, let's just remember that there's really only one payer in healthcare. And so how we distribute that is very, very important. I think it's a second point about payment is that I think that we do have, if we accept the idea that everybody should have access to an adequate level of affordable healthcare, then we as a society, all of our individuals have an obligation to make sure that can happen. And that includes financially. Therefore, I do believe that we need to look at the whole payment system and the contribution towards healthcare and seek to distribute that in a fair and adequate and a just way. It's why I look at something like the tax treatment of healthcare, and I see huge inequities and inefficiencies in that. And I want to fix it. I look at the tax treatment in that way. I look at something like Medicare, and I see a maldistribution in the Medicare system as well. People who don't need the same degree of help as others getting the equivalent, getting the same. Whereas we see people who don't get very much and don't get enough to get adequate health care. So I think looking at both the government, the taxpayers' contribution, in particular in the Medicare program, is very, very important to look at and reopen and examine and so on. That would change the way people think about that program, for example, when we start thinking in these terms. When I start thinking about the role of employers, and we may want to talk a bit more about this, sure. I think it is interesting coming from another country that, you come to the United States, and then if you have just got off the plane, people say, well, you better make sure you pick the right person to work for, because the decisions made by the employer is going to really affect whether maybe you can even go see the doctor. And I say, excuse me? Why would anybody set up a system like this? So to me, the role of the employer as both a payer, an organizer, and so on, is one of the weirdnesses of the American system. It's one case where I totally agree with people who want the single-payer system, that the place of employment and employers should not be the determinants in this that they are today. And just let me harken back to you asked me a moment ago about the principle. And what did I say? I said families should be the ultimate cause and not employers. And so I think reopening and revisiting the role of employers as payers, bearing in mind that they don't really pay, it trickles through to somebody else, organizers and so on, is absolutely central to getting this right. I think President-elect Obama kind of feels that way. I don't necessarily agree with his solution, but he's trying to edge towards that. I think others have done the same in the past.
I'll pick up where Stuart was, say a little bit more about employers. It is indeed a weird system. It's got its evolutionary roots dating back to the Second World War here in the United States. It's an ad hoc, happenstance solution to a problem that every healthcare system has to confront and solve, which is that it's necessary some way, somehow, to spread the highly variable and typically very concentrated costs of healthcare in any measured period of time in a pool so that the costs get spread over people who are currently healthy and people who are currently sick. Other countries do it collectively through the tax system and a whole national system. Some countries do it through very large groups formed through occupational categories. That's the way the Germans do it. We do it in this admittedly crazy way through employers. It's not an ideal system even for pooling because different groups of employees, different employers, have somewhat different average risks even though they are pooling over a large number of people. If you have any doubt about that, ask the GM executives about situation. So if one was God recreating the world, I doubt very much that one would choose to make the place of employment the mechanism that is used for pooling people in order to average out risks. It just happens to be what we've got. It covers 177 million people as of calendar year 2007, according to the current population survey. That's a lot of people. It's most of the population. About 25 or 30 million people buy insurance individually. So, as is the case in every democracy during peacetime, if there's not an absolute calamity, reform starts from where you are. You need to find a way of, if you want to change something, of moving gradually. It's rarely possible to do it in one large, discontinuous leap. Moving gradually away from where you are in a way that doesn't reduce overall welfare. So the challenge here is how to improve the operation or gradually replace the current pooling mechanism that we have, namely the place of employment. And in this connection, I'd like to give a plug to Stewart's colleague, Ed Hazelmeyer, who for the state of Massachusetts came up with, and I'm not sure Ed had this in mind exactly, but came up with an idea that was applied in Massachusetts and, in fact, is part of President-elect Obama's campaign platform of creating a clearinghouse, a central clearinghouse through which employers, individuals, or anybody else can buy health insurance. Now, why is this a way of improving the employment-based system? A major shortcoming with the system that we have is just what Stewart said. You change your job, you got to change your health insurer. That's crazy. But suppose you or your employer buys insurance for you through a central clearinghouse. That's the term that President-elect Obama has used. It's called a connector in Massachusetts. You get your coverage through a clearinghouse. The employer pays something. Yes, eventually it comes out of your wages, but the employer writes part of the check. You write the rest to pay for that insurance. You leave that job. You go to work someplace else. You stay with your health insurance. The next employer could pay something in, or you can pick up the tab yourself if the employer doesn't. Presto, you've gotten rid of this direct linkage between your health insurance arrangements and your place of employment. Now, that is one reason why I think this connector or clearinghouse idea has a potential to be really, really very important, even if we stay with the current workplace-based system. I want to also add, if there are any single-payer advocates out in the audience, you too can take solace from this arrangement. And the reason you can take solace from it is you could say, hey, if there is a single entity through a clearinghouse for the sale of health insurance, those who are too poor to pay on their own, not employed, there'll be government subsidies going in to take care of them. This clearinghouse will be subject to some kinds of regulations. Over time, it could be the entity for creating the kind of system that single-payer advocates actually advocate. So I think Ed and other advocates of the clearinghouse idea need to recognize that this is a protean institution that could evolve in very different ways over time. But I think it's a good place to start wherever you think it ought to end up, because it has the potential for correcting one of the more serious problems associated with current employment-based health insurance.
Could I just quickly, not exactly respond, but just add to
that? Of course,
sure. Just one little point, because I think, you know, I appreciate your commenting on our work in Massachusetts, but I think it's a good illustration of two pieces of how we need to move forward. One is, I'm glad to see that Henry's a good conservative. We've got to start with where we are and evolve slowly. He's not a radical. And I think that's absolutely right. And
that was why I couldn't support Senator McCain's program. It was the most radical program around.
Anyway, but this idea of moving forward, one can have a fundamental problem with an existing structure, but Americans are very nervous about big change in healthcare. And so moving forward, I think that's a very important point to bear in mind. And then the second thing I'll say is that, again, Americans want a system that is what they would say American, you know, and what I mean by that when you think about single payer and all sort of thing, some people will look at other countries, Britain, where I come from, and so on, and say that's what we mean, and so on. But what Henry's alluding to in terms of what do we even mean by single payer in a situation like that? If we have some entity, some exchange that allows people to select and so on. If we have a reform of the payment system and the subsidy system so we allocate money more towards people who need it and so on, is that, quote, single payer? Is it individual choice? What is it? Well, it's a unique kind of American system. We have a unique American system now that doesn't work too well. But I think we're all talking about gravitating towards a uniquely American system that appreciates how Americans think about this thing and the and where we are now. And that's why I think we can actually move together on this. I think often words and terminology get in the way. I mean, what Henry laid out, in a sense, is an employment-based system. You know, you get you sign up through the place of work, you know, you're in this exchange. It's a definitional, you know, it's semantical, really, in many respects. But what it still means is that the employer doesn't tell you exactly what you're going to get and determine it, and you don't have to worry about what mood is the president of the company in today in his meetings with Blue Cross or something like that.
And just so you all in the audience knows, my next question was going to be very pointedly, what are your thoughts on the employer-sponsored insurance system, and should it be built upon or scrapped? But I think we know your answer.
Scrapped implies we just kind of sweep it away. I think we should allow an evolution of that system. And I've written on this, for Brookings, on this, of thinking about how this evolves in the future. Sure. And this is along the lines we've just been talking about, where, you know, to the average American, what's changing in what both Henry and I have talked about? Yeah, I still show up for work. I still sign up at the place of work. It's employer-based, but now I've got more choices. I don't lose it. That's like better employment-based coverage than I have today. But is it really employment?
Right.
You know.
I want to ask one more formal question, then we're going to open it up to the audience. We've gotten quite a bit of flavor of sort of what you would do if you were in the decision-making seat, and certainly you both write quite a bit, and many, many people read your works, and hopefully the appropriate people will be reading them and many other things as they make these decisions. But give us your predictions. What is your forecast? What's going to happen in the next 12 to 24 months in the new Obama administration and the new Congress? What do you think they're going to do? What will 2 years from now, what do you think will be?
Well, Henry's a famous forecaster, so we can...
You reminded me of years and years ago, there was a famous financier named Bernard Baruch, and he was asked by the financial press to say what would happen in financial markets in the year ahead, and he stroked his chin and very soberly said, "They will fluctuate." Well, I think what we're going to see is a fair bit of attention to health care, and within the Democratic Party, a battle, a contest to see what shape the proposals should take over the next year. There is a range of views, stretching from the idea that we should have what I call the one big bill approach. Traditionally, this has been associated with Senator Kennedy, and I believe he is still working to create such a bill. There are more incremental strategies. Events, I think, are going to militate toward the incremental strategy. Indeed, Senator Baucus, who put out what some people have called a plan and I would call a program of a wide range of possible legislative actions, I think events are going to make a more incremental approach almost inescapable. Why? There are at least two issues that are coming along and have to be addressed. They're not much related to one another, but they're both very important. The first is that you'll recall there was a big brouhaha last year about renewal of the state child health insurance program. Two vetoes by President Bush. The Democrats eventually felt that all they could do and all they did do was to basically renew the old program at its old level, a bit more money than it had had in order to maintain service levels then prevailing, and they put an expiration date for March of this year. So March of this year, that bill is expiring, and something has to be done. One possibility is to use that as an occasion for a significant expansion of SCHIP. How much would depend on the configuration of political forces. That bill could be a vehicle for doing a great deal more, but my guess is that people who support that program want to make sure it's renewed and grab what can be grabbed in the way of increased coverage right now, will end up prevailing. Report today is that that Representative Waxman defeated Representative Dingell for, at least in the committee, the small committee that makes recommendations to the full Democratic caucus regarding chairmanship of the committee through which that legislation would pass. I think that there is a real likelihood that will be treated as a discrete piece of legislation. You can increase the funding for it, broaden the eligibility standards somewhat, achieve much of what Democrats tried to achieve last year. The second piece of legislation, which is less you got to do it now, but has big stake, a lot of money attached to it, is the sustainable growth rate regulations governing reimbursement of physicians under Medicare. If you want to talk about a crazy cul-de-sac to have gotten oneself into, boy, oh boy, is this ever it. A limit was set on how much total spending could go up under Part B, and if service level, total spending is price times quantity. If quantity went up faster than was assumed, then next year you had to cut back on price so that you stayed within the limit. Well, lo and behold, quantity did go up faster than projected, so Congress was supposed to cut back on price, but they took a look at it, and they said, we can't do this politically to physicians, so we'll let prices stay up, but we'll promise next year to make it up. That happened several years running, and so now there is a backlog of unfulfilled promises to cut spending, which would imply a reduction in payments to physicians, I don't know the exact number, by something like 40%. And of course, that's not going to happen. But if you acknowledge that it's not going to happen, then the budget for Part B goes up, and under PAYGO rules, you're obliged to do something about it in order to cover the cost, either cut spending someplace else or raise taxes. So this is a real tough nut. And one possibility is to sort of swallow it at once, and there'll be pressure then to waive the PAYGO rules. You can see from my description of this, it bears no policy relationship, really, to S-CHIP expansion. And it doesn't bear any direct relationship to a lot of other things that people have talked about for health care reform. There are two other areas where there's a big head of steam to do something, more resistance in one case than in the other. We've been talking about health IT for several years. David Brailer was appointed by President Bush to head a high-profile effort to encourage the implementation of health IT, but all David Brailer got was profile. He was given no money at all to push the effort, zero. The condition was spending should not increase. Everybody, right, left, and center, you look at the two platforms of the two candidates, in both of their platforms, health IT is a big deal. It's important. It really is important. It's important for the quality of health care. It's important for administrative simplification. It's important possibly for long-term cost control. Not much in the short run. Eventually, there may be some real money there. Does that bear any relationship to S-CHIP or to sustainable growth rate? I don't think so. So that would tend to be discrete. And then the final area where there is a great deal of broad intellectual consensus and a great deal of very targeted unease and resistance is to set up a real politically insulated institute to study cost effectiveness. Again, right, left, and center, there's a widespread belief that such an organization could produce information that would contribute in a significant way to the improvement of the quality of health care and could be used by payers to justify not paying for some things for which self-interested providers are now lobbying And there's nothing on the other side to say you're a self-interested lobbyer and what you propose to do won't do a whole lot of good. But if such an entity existed was able to provide solid information, there would be a basis for doing that, which is precisely the reason why, in principle, it's a great idea, but there are all kinds of people out there who are extremely nervous about actually creating such an entity. I haven't mentioned, Stuart, in my favorite idea, which is that while the federal government is struggling on trying to figure out what to do to extend coverage, it would be nice if they smiled benignly, provided regulatory and some legislative flexibility to states, and maybe some financial support as well for state efforts to extend coverage in the manner that Massachusetts has undertaken to do. What I've listed are five separate steps which cumulatively, I think, would be have a very profound impact on the evolution of our healthcare system, but they certainly don't qualify as one big bill.
I agree very much with Henry's sort of portrayal of the dynamics on the Hill, so I won't kind of elaborate on that. Let me just make three kind of quick points. One is, I think, just to underscore what he said at the very beginning, that there is a very profound tension between those who say, let's go forward in a slow, incremental way, and those who want to go forward in a big way. And it's a true tension, both politically as well as substantively. Politically, because of the fear that many people have that if you don't do it all in one as quickly as possible, you will run out of political steam and political capital very rapidly. And if, for example, the Hill was to focus on the SCHIP bill, that may be all you get. And it may be another 15 years before what have you got, really, if you only expand it a bit? I mean, it's good, of course, to do that, but you're not really thinking about big reform. So I think that's a real tension. I think, secondly, that I think there is probably going to be a lot of interest in ideas like IT improvement and this kind of thing, because not just because I think it is a good thing in itself, but because to Americans, the idea that you can fix it by just improving record keeping and cutting down paperwork sounds like a really good solution that doesn't involve changing anything or tough decisions. And Americans kind of want that. And I think the political system is going to be drawn to that more and more. Therefore, I do foresee a modest expansion of SCHIP and an IT bill wound up together as being it, essentially. So I think that's kind of point. And then the last point I'll just make on the other side of the coin, in a sense, is that, you know, I mean, and Henry and I were both here for some years in terms of this, but looking at the Clinton period of healthcare and so on, I am very, not surprised exactly, but pleasantly surprised, maybe, is the right word, at, in fact, what is going on in terms of the conversation on the Hill. Senator Baucus, I mean, the fact that the Senate Finance Chairman brings out a program, a discussion document. I mean, he called it a white paper. That is a term that's used in Britain to describe, here's the government's sort of basic proposals. What do you think about it? Before they push through legislation. That, Senator Kennedy's very inclusive. I mean, so inclusive that I get included. You're not keeping anybody out of the club when I get to go and see, you know, Senator Kennedy's staff. I think he's very important. I don't think it's just window dressing. I think it's an honest recognition that we're only going to get action if we are inclusive. Very different from the early 90s, where you had, you know, a statement of principle, a speech, that, like on one page, and then a secret sort of, you know, group of people coming up with the plan, and then trying to push it through. It's a totally different process now. I think that's good. I think it's likely to lead to better policy making. It's likely to increase the probability of something happening that really is broadly agreeable to people, not that everybody will like, but moves forward. So, you know, I think it's going to be a very interesting dynamic in terms of what actually happens. Sure. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion by any means. Yeah. I think there's all sorts of differences this time than what we've seen before. Everybody I know, even people I totally disagree with, they all desperately want to get it right this time. and there's less sort of triumphalism about, you know, we won, we're just going to push through what we want, than we might have expected.
Well, it's very interesting to hear you describe perhaps the patience that folks should watch this process with. I think many of us recall our colleagues and, in fact, our mentors or supervisors' description of what happened in the early 90s as that was our shot. Here we are 20 years later. Here's our shot for 20 years from now. And perhaps perhaps one of the lessons from tonight is that there is it'll be a building process that may not necessarily be one shot in the dark. But I did want to – we want to open it up to folks now. We have a bit of time to take questions. Kate's in the back that has a mic, and so we can she can come along and we can take questions from there. We can start on here on the side, Ben.
Well, Henry and I should sit and walk around and sure. Turn our backs to each
other. If you just want to say briefly your name and where you work, that would be great.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ben Lum, and I'm with HHS. And I'm wondering if you could comment on our possible new boss at HHS, Tom Daschle, at least reported, and what his particular views and skill set might bring for the next couple of years, and maybe does it indicate anything about President-elect Obama's, what he intends to do?
Interesting.
You want to try that first?
Senators reported offering of the job and reportedly accepting the job.
Yes, and not just that job. Very importantly, the report I read was that one of Daschle's conditions was that he would also be named the White House advisor on health care. And that was to avoid having done to him what Ira Magaziner did to Donna Shalala during the Clinton years, which is to say, take health care planning away from HHS and move it into the White House. Now, eventually, if there's to be a large bill of any kind on health care, it really has to be done with White House supervision as a practical matter. It may well be that that isn't the course that's followed, or that even if it is, a cabinet secretary is in charge of that. I think it's good news in two senses. Senator Daschle was present at the beginning of Senator Obama's run for the presidency, is reported to have strongly counseled him to do it because these sorts of opportunities don't repeat themselves readily, and grab it while you can. If that report is true, it's both good advice and it must be highly valued advice, which gives Senator Daschle a certain legitimacy and weight in President-elect Obama's counsels that many others don't have. Senator Daschle is not traditionally heavily into health care, but he has just co-authored a book on health care reform with two other authors, one of whom is Gene Lambrew, and I don't remember who the third is. Gene Lambrew worked in the Clinton administration. She's been at the Center for American Progress for some time, and she certainly does know health care. So I think this is an augury that President-elect Obama does want to make health care a significant and important issue. How significant and how important and how upfront it will be is going to depend on events that none of us can forecast. And indeed, during an interview, Mr. Obama said that healthcare was second. Actually third. The economy is first, energy was second, healthcare was third. I don't know whether it's going to play out that way, and we can't forecast what events are going to put in the as roadblocks. The key point is there's a trusted, experienced, savvy person who enjoys the President-elect's confidence, who will be at HHS, and who is interested in health care.
Stuart, what are your thoughts on Senator Daschle's?
Yes, I think that I kind of agree with Henry's characterization of the senator in terms of his his background and interest and so on. I agree with that. The point I really want to make, or at least I want to leave for people to think about, is this, if this is in fact an agreement that if he takes this position, then the center of gravity of healthcare policy making will be in HHS rather than the White House. I think that's a very interesting kind of political science issue, whether that will actually work. You know, in terms of theories about how presidents get their agendas through, I would say the conventional thinking, I think, learned the hard way, is that this has to be, you know, absolutely aggressively managed through the White House. If you have, you know, a fiefdom out in HHS where the, an independent person with a different view than the advisors that will exist on this issue within the White House, you could be setting up a dynamic that could be very problematic for getting something done. And I think this is a political science issue. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Sure. I mean, White Houses and White House staffs have personality. Agency staffs have personality. Hill staff have personalities. And getting those things to work together is not a simple thing. And the downside of at least if this is an agreement with Senator Daschle, of having kind of an independent, you know, entity over here, could easily become at war with the White House. I mean, yeah, they're all talking nice to each other right now, but let's see when everything starts to be put into place and the pressure starts to come. And that's what I think is going to be interesting to see how it's resolved, if it is resolved.
One comment I heard earlier this week from a colleague who works in a prominent Senate office, this is obviously prior to Senator Daschle's appointment, but regarding Senator Daschle, is that this is someone who was the foremost, you know, former senior most ranking member in the Senate, and so obviously is very tied to the legislative body. Many of his colleagues and friends are there. Mm-hmm. And so the ability, which had not been necessarily the case for decades, of someone at HHS in that position to link very closely to the Senate, in particular for legislative.
Right, but there's a downside to that too, which is that the tendency which we've seen in many administrations for an agency and the people in the agency to be working with the Hill, essentially against the White House. And I don't just mean when it's in different control of different parties. There's a dynamic there that's very easy to start to happen, and it can lead to all sorts of complexities, sure. Let me put it that way. And I don't know, maybe this won't happen, but maybe we will see change.
Sure.
But let's be aware that there are you know, strengths and weaknesses of having a strong, independent cabinet secretary on someone, if this is how it turns out to be, in the context of the whole program of administration, the internal dynamics of the White House, the relationship with the Hill, who speaks for the administration, you know? Yeah. Is it the OMB director? Is it, you know, who is it? This can get very complicated, and we've seen big mistakes in the past, including with Bill Clinton and others before him on this.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to watch, very interesting appointment. We had another question up here, the gentleman, yeah.
If
we could wait for the mic.
Tim Fry with the National Rural Health Association. Question is back to the health information exchanges that you both talked about. I think you said connectors in Massachusetts. The closest analogy that I have seen in my professional career is the Medicare Advantage plans, and this might be incorrect, but the way I would see it is asking seniors to go online and look at a variety of plans on the Medicare CMS website and figure out which one makes the most sense for them personally. Unfortunately, in the experience that I saw, some of these health plans had, or health companies had, 20 or 30 different plans, making it very complicated to pick what would be the perfect plan for a single individual, and that's assuming that all your normal care continues as is. Is that not how you would see it, or how would you characterize a situation where these health exchange plans would offer so many options that it would almost be too overwhelming?
Yeah.
The analog, the more appropriate analog, is actually the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. And indeed, if you listen to Senator Obama, President-elect Obama, talking about his vision of an exchange, that's what he talks about. It isn't just, he talks about, you know, the health care there. Member of Congress has, but the architecture, a national exchange, which is what you have there. It's not going online and so on. The federal employee program as an exchange existed before you could go online. And it's not that so much. It is an architecture, as Henry said, that allows payments to be made, information to be provided, certain rules of who gets to play in this, and so on. That's really what we're talking about in this. It's the online aspect of it is a facility that you can have, and federal employees use that. But the architecture, what we're really talking about, preceded the ability to use the internet to do this, and so on. It's a whole kind of system that I think is very intriguing. It is the basis of what was talked about in Massachusetts, and other states are looking at it. And I think when Senator Obama talks about a health exchange, that's what he's talking about.
I don't know. I think the question you raise is central and very important. For many years, for example, Alan Entoven at Stanford, an advocate of so-called managed competition, has emphasized that if individuals are to operate effectively in the marketplace, to police insurers who are offering different products, it's very important to limit the range of choice to a small enough number of options so that a normal person can evaluate them. In the case, for example, of Medigap plans, the supplemental insurance that people buy on their own to top up Medicare benefits, for many years there was such a confusion of plans offered with such varying terms and different payout rates, nobody could make head or tails of it, and some of the plans were just god-awful. I mean, they were real rip-offs. So Congress decided and implemented a system under which there's a limited number of prototype plans. Any company that wants to offer those plans in a particular area may do so, but it's a small enough number so that certainly with assistance, the elderly and the disabled, most of them anyway, can decide which one fits their wants best. Now, that pattern raises a question of whether members of Congress, executive-level officials, will take a look at this clearinghouse and say, hey, we want this to operate basically along the lines that managed competition advocates have stressed, and therefore we're going to impose a set of regulations on the structure. They'll be diverse, but there'll be a limited number of plans that could be offered. That may not be what is now under discussion. The truth of the matter is the platform documents are so general, it's very hard to know exactly what specific legislation would implement those principles. A wide range of different legislation could implement those principles. I don't know how this kind of an arrangement evolves. It could be highly unstructured, where it looks very much like the FEHBP does today. It could look like the Medigap market. It could take some other form, and all of those would be broadly consistent with the principles enunciated in Senator Obama's campaign platform. Right. So I think we have to wait and see. And a lot's going to hinge on what choices get made there.
No, I think that's right. I mean, that within this sort of basic architecture, you can, in fact, you can envision different models. And I mentioned the FEHBP just because I do think that it's a model people are familiar with. It works. It's been around for a long time. It seems to give sufficient choice, you know, 10 to 15 plans. It doesn't have what the Medigap market has in terms of very kind of very rigid sort of names for different types of plans. But it seems to kind of work. I don't know many members of Congress or federal employees that want to scrap it, and so on. And it has a negotiation, and so it's very difficult for a plan to get into the FEHB and rip people off because it's got to pass muster in a kind of a soft way, and so on. So I think there's a lot of opportunities there, and I think that's the way to think about it as a starting point at least. And I take your point very well that, and Americans say this too, that, you know, too much choice is just too much. I mean, Americans want... You know, often when Americans say they want choice in health care, they don't mean what some of my friends at the Cato Institute would say. You know, they want a telephone book size of choices that they can negotiate with their brain surgeon. That's not what they mean. They basically really mean, if my doctor tells me I should have something, I need to be able to choose that. That's really how most people make these kinds of, that's kind of what they actually mean. So it's got to be sufficient and so on. I think, and that's, and this is what's got to be worked on. This is where people have, in good faith, can look at these different models and so on. As we're evolving away from one system, we've got to be aware that people can be confused by any change, and maybe you include something early on that's a little bit more organized than you really need, so that people are comfortable with it, and then you ease up. There are all sorts of ways of moving forward in this. But I think if you really want to look at the architecture of an exchange, I mean, look at the FDHP, think about it, talk to people who are in it, many of you presumably are in it, yeah. And just sort of think about how it works, how you get information, how you make decisions, how you use consumers' checkbook, things like this.
Yeah. I think it's a very timely question. We are now in open enrollment season for the tens of thousands of federal employees that are here in the area and those of us in local government as well. So it isn't always easy to pick through some of those plans, for educated health policy people.
Yeah, it's easy to stay with what you have.
So, yeah,
another
question? We have others? Yeah.
Yeah.
If you could wait for the mic so it's on the camera.
I guess this question is very much open to either of you, but how would you respond to the charge that the very discussion of health policy involves some sort of transfer or redistribution of wealth, if you will? And to the extent that you guys, either of you would accept that, is it really within the legitimacy of the U.S. government to mandate that?
Can you introduce yourself as well?
Oh, sorry. My name is Jeff, and I'm a professional economist.
Mm-hmm. Great. I think Jeff's point returns us to the notion of that healthcare is inexplicably linked to tax policy. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that there's a transfer of resources in some way. If as a basic value of your society, as a membership right of society, whatever you want to describe it, access to affordable health care is in some way a membership right in some way, or membership benefit, then there's got to be some change. Who should do it, how it should be organized, and so on. I think that's where you want to devise an American system. You don't want to have the government arbitrarily doing it. You don't want to have, and one of the concerns I have with one of the things that Senator Daschle has spoken about, some kind of independent board that isn't answered to anybody, doesn't return your calls, but just figures out the best way to give health care and how to move things around, and you just get what it decides. I don't think that's how people would think of it. But the role of government is, in my view, it should be limited, transparent, and in line with empowering people to make those basic decisions. But yes, there's going to be a transfer of wealth. That's true if you assure people of adequate education, K through 12. It's true of all of these things which you, as a society, you make some assurance or guarantee with people. And yeah, I worry about the government doing it, but I know that you've got to have some kind of social architecture, community architecture to do that. And certainly in the areas, say, of taxation, if you're trying to move money around through the tax system and remove some of the inequities in the current tax treatment of healthcare, I don't know how else you can do that without the government and the IRS being involved in doing it. I don't know how you would do it.
I think one of the reasons why what I'll call systemic healthcare reform has been talked about but not enacted over the years is that an approximately uniform national system that is different from what we have now and that doesn't spend a whole lot more money necessarily redistributes a whole lot of money among different providers and recipients. And if you do spend more money, it redistributes money between taxpayers and recipients of health care services. Redistributional politics in the United States is mud wrestling. It's very difficult, and it's usually not, if done on a large scale, highly successful. So I think the redistributional side of things is one of the reasons why it will be easier to tackle SCHIP than tackle SGR and do something about IT and so on. On the issue of who decides what, this gets to the question of why choice is important and what it means exactly. Choice can refer to the selection of different kinds of insurance coverage, what your cost sharing is, your deductibles, your co-payments, whether dental services are or are not included, things of that kind. Choice can refer to whether you have access to all the physicians in your community, a broad panel of physicians, or just a very narrow and tightly constrained one. Choice can refer to the degree of flexibility that you and a physician have in selecting a medication or a treatment method for a particular illness. The same word, choice, for these wildly different dimensions of variability within the complex healthcare system. We know next to nothing about which of those choice dimensions is most important to individuals. But having said we know next to nothing, and that's I can use the singular first person pronoun, I know next to nothing, that's not going to stop me from telling you what I think is probably most important. I think that people get really upset if they have lack of access to a broad range of physicians, that the welfare consequences of different kinds of co-payments and deductibles are really very small, and that limitations on choice in that dimension are far less significant than limitations on choice in the other dimension. Stuart was referring to Senator Daschle's suggestion, which his co-author Gene Lambrew has been pushing hard, for a board that would review the evidence on which forms of medical interventions yield benefits or are most cost-effective. My own view is that that kind of regulation is going to be difficult and probably impossible if it involves flat prohibitions, but that it is desirable and would in the long run be sustainable if it involved different terms for payment. You can have whatever you want, but if you take the generic, you pay less than if you take the drug still under patent, particular treatments for a given condition are covered more adequately if the evidence indicates that those are more cost-effective treatments. But you want the other one? Your doctor says you need it. You can have it, but there's an extra cost for it. I think one really has to get down in the weeds as to what choice means, and that it is deadly to intelligent debate to simply invoke choice as a primitive virtue that has to be maximized in all dimensions.
Right. Thanks. Do we have a few others? Let me go way in the back. Let's see.
I don't think this works. Oh, there it goes. Yeah. My name is Adam Bloomfield, and I'm a health economic researcher at the Lewin Group. And this is a broad question, but a common criticism of our system is that there's a significant disconnect between physician pay, physician reimbursement, and actual healthcare outcomes. I guess my question is, should addressing this issue be a centerpiece of any major healthcare reform? And if so, what mechanisms would that entail?
I think everybody agrees, not everybody, but the vast majority of people agree that there are big differences in terms of outcomes or value for money, both in terms of types of services and in different parts of the country and so on. And I think it's very easy then to say, well, we should do something about that and make sure that we don't pay for things that are unnecessary. We live in Washington and we live in a political system. How you do that becomes very, very difficult to do. I mean, if it costs twice as much to do the same thing in Florida as in Minnesota, the natural assumption would be, well, you don't pay so much in Florida. Try doing that. The people in Minnesota say, we only get half what the people in Florida get. I've got a solution to that, and so on. It's very difficult politically. So I think the premise is correct. There is some disagreement about precisely what is value for money and so on, but putting that aside for the moment, even if you identify this, doing something about it just gets you straight into the heart of the sort of the political sort of jungle that we're going to find here in terms of how you try to get something done, which is why it's so easy for analysts to say, well, there's 40% waste in the health system. We can get 40% out. We can expand coverage. We've fixed quality. It's done. People at Lewin can say, look at the numbers. It's all figured out. But try to get that through the Congress in a way that deals with the AMA and the specialty groups and the Florida delegation and so on and so forth. And it's very, very difficult. So it's a theoretical issue that may, in political practice, be very difficult to address. But we should try.
The problem that you're describing is we pay the surgeon to do the operation. We pay somebody else to follow up with the patient after he or she leaves the hospital. We pay the physical therapist who helps the person get back functionality after the operation, and they're each separate and they each go their own way. Wouldn't it be better if we made a single payment to some entity who was responsible for maintaining the health level of the patient? And the answer is, yeah, I guess so. I'm not sure how to do that, but I think there is a practical step now under discussion that was the subject of a lengthy chapter in a recent MedPAC report, and that is the proposal to move to so-called episode-based payment, typically in the case of hospitalization, where there would be a single payment for whatever causes the hospitalization and follow-up treatment. The advantage of this approach is that it vests the group of providers responsible for care throughout that episode with joint responsibility. They have to figure out how the money ought to be spent, and the one can apply metrics to the outcomes and, for example, pay for performance through such episode-based care, giving more to those who have better overall records. Technically, it's extremely difficult, and MedPAC stressed those difficulties and the need for great caution and care in moving ahead. The Commonwealth Foundation, in a report, the one I've mentioned now twice, Bending the Curve, has a long menu of methods to reform the healthcare system that could save money. Number one on the list over the long haul is effectiveness research. As I recall, number two was episode-based reimbursement. So I think you put your finger on something that's really quite important. It's complicated. It's illustrative of how easy it is, and many people do it. You clearly were not, to talk about just doing this, and wouldn't things be wonderful if we did, as Stuart said, all of these things are minefields. But this is one that I think is promising, and over the years, I think we're going to see movement on this change in the way we pay providers.
Great. Well, thank you. That was a very critical question, obviously, on what are we purchasing for in healthcare. We know we pay the most of anywhere in the country, in the world, and yet our return on investment is somewhat alarmingly low in that sense, and outcomes still persist. We, for time reasons, unfortunately, we can't take any more questions. We're going to have to wrap up very shortly. I did want to give both panelists literally 60 seconds to give sort of a closing statement. I know both of you are very verbose and like to talk a lot. And so for 60 seconds, just what imparting thoughts, bearing in mind that many of the folks in this room are hope to perhaps follow in your footsteps in the kinds of sort of both scholarly and public policy work words of advice for the members here that are here to taking and developing their health policy career?
Well, I would just say that, I think, first of all, there's a great opportunity in front of us right now in terms of health reform. And the kind of collegial conversation is very important to engage in. I think when you hear people use words in the healthcare system, it often creates barriers or seeming barriers, which really are less real than one would imagine. And therefore, I think if you're really going to really make a career in this area and be and have an influence on what happens, it is very important to reach out and to work with people and not to be put off by, you know, words that might describe them or what the words they use. Because this really, you know, in large part is a conversation more about technical disagreements or the search for technical solutions and a political assessment of what can be done, what, rather than some kind of big ideological dispute. And therefore, people can work together, and I would encourage you to do that.
Great. Henry, some parting words of wisdom?
We all want to have a good job and make an adequate living. I'm sure each of you is in that position. We also want to be able to go home at night and genuinely feel we've done something worthwhile that's good and important. Working on making our health system operate more effectively, I think, is about as good as it gets in all of those dimensions. Now, you're not going to make as much money as people used to think they would in finance, but you may have the last laugh. But I would call to your attention a variety of studies done by different economists with different political views using different analytical methods, each of which reached the conclusion that over the past 3 or 4 decades, the improvements in health outcomes in the United States have a value, and economists measure these things, as great as that of all the economic growth that has occurred in the country over that period of time. Everybody agrees that the way we deliver health care today in the United States fails to realize the potential of modern medicine. So while you have good jobs and you're drawing down what I hope will be very satisfactory incomes, you can know that if you do your jobs well, you will have contributed to improvements in the well-being of the population of the United States, and there'll be spillovers elsewhere in the world, as much as probably anybody doing anything. So keep at it, don't get tired, and good luck.
Couldn't have scripted any better. Why don't we thank our panelists so much for coming out tonight, both Stuart Henry and Stuart Butler and Henry Aaron. We do appreciate so much. They've spent some time with us in the past at other events as well. We appreciate them spending another evening with us. Just as a reminder, we, with the Society for Young Health Policy Professionals, who put this event on, and I'm fortunate enough to work with them as the chair of the social committee, we have events like this and many others, as Kate mentioned earlier in the event. We have something coming up with Alice Rivlin on the 2nd of December. She's the former OMB head under President Clinton. In fact, was the first female OMB head ever, and had run the CBO prior to that, and so follows the path of the potentially newly appointed OMB head. I saw it on the ticker downstairs in Kaiser as the breaking news comes in. So we're very fortunate to talk to her about not just health, but the economy and poverty and the interconnectedness of those things. And we will be doing a skill building workshop on the 10th of December and talk about resume writing skills. A lot of jobs are opening up probably in the next 6 months, so you all should brush up on that. We'll be doing a happy hour and a food drive on the 12th. We recognize not only is it time for us to socialize and learn, but also to sort of give back to the local community as the winter gets cold and heading into the holiday season, helping to gather some food, both on the 12th at the happy hour, and then on the 13th, we're doing the event with Food for All, where we distribute food to low-income families that have some struggling needs, meeting their nutritional needs. So we look forward to having you with all that. You'll be able to get it through the email. Thanks again so much. Thank you to Kaiser for hosting this, as always, and for webcasting it so it's available for you and your friends who were not able to be here tonight. And I want to thank Kate in particular for helping host this event. It was fantastic in doing so. Thank you again to Stuart and Henry for letting us have the opportunity to sort of glean more of how we can move forward in what may be the most exciting time in health reform, at least for many of us that are emerging in the health policy field, perhaps until the next 20-year period where we talk about it. Hopefully by then things will look a lot better so that we don't have to sit on the panel at that time and comment on on this period. But with that, we'd like to thank you all for coming out. Thank you again, Stuart and Henry, and hope everyone has a good evening. Thank you.